Global warming is back on the front burner with the news during the week that we pumped a record amount of carbon into the atmosphere last year. So are we all doomed? It's the anniversary of the brutal Israeli attack on the Turkish ship, the Mavi Marmara, in which 9 of my friends died. As fighting intensifies, Barack Obama has urged the Yemen president to stand down. Bit late Barack, I call him. And is the West looking for a way out of Afghanistan by negotiating with the Taliban? We'll find out shortly, I promise you. All of this is the real deal.
Ow, just the way you move. Bye. It's a real deal. Bye. And the way you groove. Oh, it's the way I feel it. Bye. You're a wild thing and you're a natural star. Baby, you're the real deal.
Welcome to The Real Deal with me, George Galloway, on Press TV every week at this time in central London, bringing you the news and views you just won't find in the corporate media. As always, shooting from the hip and shooting from the lip, but you could fire back at me, at least by email, at realdeal@presstv.co.uk. In one of the most significant moves of the last few days, Britain and the United States are pressing for sanctions against 18 senior Taliban leaders to be lifted. These were imposed in 1999 when the Taliban were in power and were strengthened after 9/11. This is the strongest indication yet that the West is looking for a negotiated peace settlement with the Taliban. The Taliban, however, may well see this as a sign of weakness and halting determination, as well they might. The message is meant to be that if the Taliban put down their weapons, they can be reintegrated into society, just like the 18 former commanders, who include the controversial former head of the regime's religious police, Mohammad Kalamuddin, whose officers were responsible for some of the worst Taliban atrocities. His police beat women and men in the streets to enforce the Taliban's rigorous interpretation of Islam. Kalamuddin also issued his own edicts, including a ban on women wearing makeup or high heels, although he now says that he's put all that behind him. Well, he would, wouldn't he? But there have already been regular meetings between US representatives and the Taliban, even people posing as the Taliban, as well as the Afghan government talking directly to the people they're fighting, obviously. Western forces have been in Afghanistan now for 10 years. Scores of thousands have been killed on both sides, and my prediction is that this war won't go far beyond its 11th anniversary, with foreign troops pulling out in what will be described as an honourable peace. But it's actually all been a grotesque, costly and bloody fiasco. If we had bombarded the Afghans with a fraction of the billions of dollars and pounds spent on trying to kill them, Afghanistan would today be one of the most prosperous and, yes, peaceful places on the planet. But we don't do things that way. Benighted Yemen is close to civil war as government troops and tribal leaders now back it out. Dozens of people were killed on Wednesday in the capital, Sana'a. Yemen used to be a key US ally under its president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, in the campaign against what they called Al-Qaeda in the peninsula. But now America wants him to go, but it's a bit late after 32 years in power. It's taken a long time to get round to that. First Saleh said he would go, then he said he wouldn't. In fact, he's repeated both of those several times. There's a peace plan on the table, but Saleh isn't accepting it. 4 months of peaceful mass protests turned to fighting last week between Saleh's security forces and fighters loyal to the head of the Hashid, Yemen's most powerful tribal coalition, Sheikh Sadiq al-Ahmar. The end, when it comes, is likely to be grisly. There seems no end to the battles in Libya. Despite the NATO warplanes and Apache helicopters, Muammar Gaddafi is still there. On Wednesday, residents of several towns in the west of the country were celebrating after rebel fighters ended months of siege by forces loyal to Gaddafi. The rebels claim to have successfully liberated the towns of Qasr al-Hajj and Shakchuk, which have been under attack since the 25th of February. Sorry, but who really knows what's going on in Libya? It's descending into a bitter, tragic farce, one which is costing the British taxpayer more than £7 million a day. And for what? Ah, well, that would be the oil. But one tyrant, at least, was banged up in a cell last week, Ratko Mladic. He faces 11 charges of genocide, war crimes and crimes against humanity for his role as Serbian commander of the troops which besieged Sarajevo and massacred 8,000 Bosnian Muslim men in Srebrenica in the civil war in what we used to call Yugoslavia. Mladic is in a cell in The Hague awaiting trial before a UN war crimes court. Apparently, he'll have to make his own coffee and make his own bed. Apparently, a hardship for the ex-general used to being waited on hand and foot. One of those who will testify against Mladic is Siad Bekric, who was 14 years old when he was blinded by artillery fire on a schoolyard in Srebrenica.
Memories from the war will never leave my mind and from most people and victims of Bosnia war. When I heard that Ratko Mladic was arrested, I was truly surprised. When you go through horror that we went through and losing our loved ones through horrible crimes, you'll never have closure.
Other suspected war criminals not sharing adjoining cells are Tony Blair and George W. Bush. Another great survivor pulled it off again midweek when the septuagenarian Sepp Blatter retained his stranglehold on world football. Never mind the corruption allegations which have swirled around him for decades, or most recently in a campaign mounted by the British press and the English FA, he was re-elected as FIFA president overwhelmingly. But Blatter is promising to clean up the organisation. And who has he enlisted to head it? Why, another suspected war criminal, Henry Kissinger. Here's Henry with his latest squeeze. As the great US satirist Tom Lehrer put it, when Kissinger was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1973, political satire is now obsolete. Clearly, football satire is now too. A year ago, 9 peace campaigners, colleagues and friends of mine were slain on the good ship Mavi Marmara by Israeli commandos. On Tuesday in Gaza, the Palestine Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh unveiled a memorial to them. The memorial includes 9 10-meter-high metal statues shaped as sails and a new public park. Hundreds watched the somber ceremony. I was giving a speech in Texas when news came through of the attack, and from that moment, almost all the news and comment about the onslaught in international waters has been shaped by Israel. First of all, it was claimed the protesters had guns. Then that changed to them launching unwarranted physical attacks with iron bars and knives. All of it, from my point of view, at least concocted by the Israeli propaganda machine to blackguard these brave people, one of whom, incidentally, was the best-selling Swedish author Henning Mankell. Which brings me to my first guest, Professor Greg Filo of Glasgow University's world-renowned media group. He has a book out now called More Bad News from Israel. Greg, welcome back to The Real Deal, my friend.
See you again.
Now, I was just mentioning the attack on the Mavi Marmara and how Israel has shaped the news agenda around that, so much so that what I said earlier in this introduction about the Mavi Marmara is not, in fact, the words I would have chosen, but the words I have been censored by Ofcom into using. That's an example of how Israel always comes out on top when the spin doctors start spinning, isn't it?
The attack on the Mavi Marmara is interesting. We did that in our report and in our book, the More Bad News from Israel. We did a whole chapter on that, actually. And what I thought was interesting was that you have a situation in which the Israelis are, in that case, able to not only control the message, they physically control the people. So all of the people were taken, actually on the ship, and taken to Israel. And then the Israelis were able to, as you know, issue an edited video account of what was supposed to have happened. And it had its own labels on it with words like the soldier being attacked with iron or metal bar and things like this. So that the audience was sort of physically directed into how they were to understand. Now, I don't think Ofcom or anybody else in the authorities objected to that, but I wonder what would have happened if, for example, there had been a contested incident in the West Bank, for example, and supposing the Palestinians had issued a piece of video which had labels on it saying brutal Israeli soldier attacking innocent Palestinian, would the television in this country have featured that? And would they have kept featuring it night after night if the Israelis were saying, well, actually, that isn't what happened. That's not the truth. We don't accept the validity of this. You know, do you see what I mean? It's extraordinary that account could just be carried, and it's not seen.
Well, it becomes the prevailing orthodoxy, Greg, doesn't it? I mean, most of us watching this will instinctively feel that way, but it's only thanks to the work that you've done, first in Bad News from Israel and now More Bad News from Israel, that we can actually see it scientifically calibrated, right down to the number of lines of text given in news bulletins to the Israeli narrative, compared to the lines of text given by the Palestinian victims of, for example, the attack on Gaza 2008-2009. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's a big part of the book, and also of public understanding as well. And we did show that the Israeli account dominated there, particularly in the explanations of the crisis, the explanations and origins of the conflict, things like that. And what we've been saying is not that only one side should be represented. We've said that if we have an interest at all, it's in starting a debate about peace, about possible ways of resolving the conflict. And that to do that, you need to have a proper debate about the reasons and origins of it. And what's happening on television is that really only one side, that's the Israeli side, is getting its account out again and again of why all this conflict has happened, what it's about, what its origins are, the reasons for it. And when, since the book appeared, you'll know there's a lot on YouTube and other places of people giving speeches talking about the content of it. And it generated an enormous, ferocious attack from people who didn't agree with the book or what I was saying. And I went on some of the websites where they're saying, the BBC and TV is biased against Israel. And I replied and I said, look, you can summarize the two cases really without too much difficulty, very quickly. The Israelis say, we are fighting terrorists. This is the war on terror. We want peace. We keep being attacked and we have to respond. The Palestinians would say, we lost our homes and our land when Israel was created. We live under military rule. Israel is a kind of terrorist state. This is a kind of apartheid. We have thousands of our people locked up without trial, that we are under this brutal regime and we're trying to overthrow it. Now, those are two quite clearly distinct cases. Now, what I said on the website was, ask yourself, which of these do you think is most often on BBC News? Which do you think that these two is featured? And if you think that the second one is featured as much as the first, actually it doesn't get on at all, hardly the second one. If you really think that, then do your own study, do your own examination.
Well, of course, the historical memory of some of the journalists, as I put it in a celebrated altercation on Sky News with Anna Botting, stretches back at most weeks, if not just days. And therefore the narrative, which would say there's an extant conflict here because one group of people used to live in a country from which they have been driven. And they're now refugees outside for 60 years or 40 plus years. And those who are inside, most of them, are living either under occupation or under siege. And that inevitably sets up a conflict, a confrontation. That historical memory is either not known by the journalists in the BBC, and that I know that in one or two cases, Jeremy Bowen and Paul Adams' son, isn't the case. But either the BBC hierarchy doesn't know that historic truth, or they are suppressing it, from my point of view.
My view is that the journalists just can't see it, can't say it. I mean, sorry, they understand it, they know the history, they're not stupid, the people on the ground know what's happening, but I think that they create, all kinds of problems are created if they start to go into the Palestinian account of the origins of it. That's not to say that everything they do is then biased in favor of Israel. What tends to happen, what we showed in the book, which I thought was very interesting, was that there's a sort of displacement, sort of strange process where the journalists feel they have to do some kind of balance. So what they do is to balance the account of the effects of the Israeli action, like on, for example, civilians, on women, on children. So you get a lot of coverage on the news of casualties, and it's quite clear that that the journalists are sympathetic. So they're saying, you know, about quite clearly about the terrible things that have happened. But then that is balanced in a strange way with the Israeli account of why it's supposed to have happened. So you don't get the causes from the point of view of the Palestinians, but you do get an image of Palestinian suffering. So you get the Palestinian suffering balanced with the Israeli account of why it has to happen.
Well, you do, Greg, but it's in a way anonymized because the Palestinian victims are nameless, backgroundless, familyless, corpses or mutilated people. On the other hand, if, God forbid, an explosion occurs in Tel Aviv today, the television will hone in, personalize the victim's family, background, practically their front and back garden will feature on the news. As if, as somebody put it, the Israeli victims of this conflict are somehow people like us, and the Palestinian victims of it are the other.
There are some elements of that, but there are really, if you look at the book, there are clearly places where the journalists are very sympathetic to Palestinian suffering. But the big problem for the Palestinians is they don't get their case across. So then when you go out, I mean, I think they're stopped, if you like, from getting the case across. But then when you go out to the focus groups, you interview people in the population, what happens is that people will say to you, well, of course, the Palestinians have got a case and it's very sad and what's happening to them is terrible and you can see how awful it is. But if only they'd stop firing the rockets and if only they'd stop starting the trouble and if only they'd sit down and go for peace, you know. So they repeat the Israeli narrative even though they've actually seen the images of the suffering.
Amazing.
And that, I think, is a big finding of the book.
Well, it is. It's an outstanding book, Greg. I don't have a hat on, but if I did, I'd take it off to you. Greg Filo, Glasgow University, the media group, which is responsible for scientifically calibrating the institutional bias against the Palestinian point of view on the BBC. Thanks very much indeed for joining us, Greg, and I hope that the book sells very well indeed, as it deserves to. There are about 6 million people, 7 million nearly, who have watched my encounter with Anna Botting of Sky News on YouTube in several different languages. It's been posted up 20, 30, 40 different times. And it was a very long interview. And I'm grateful to Sky for allowing that interview to run. And the reason that they did so is that I think for the first time, maybe for the only time on a mainstream broadcaster, we got right down to brass tacks. It was raw, it was cut to the bone, but it was head to head with both of the narratives there being debated. Call me immodest, but I think that I won the argument. Check it out if you don't believe me on YouTube, if you haven't done already. Now, stay with me. I'll be talking about global warming coming up, but after this.
Ow! Just the way you move, it's a real deal. And the way you groove, it's the way I feel it. You're a wild thing and you're a natural star. Baby, you're the real deal.
Now, I mentioned at the top of the show how we're choking the planet to death with carbon emissions. I was not exaggerating. There was a record rise last year, according to the International Energy Agency. We seem to be on course for catastrophic and irreversible climate change. Well, we're going to be talking to Oliver Tickell. He's from the Kyoto 2 Research Group. And he joins me now again by Skype. Welcome, Oliver. Are we doomed? And if not doomed, what can we do at this late hour to save ourselves and the planet from being so?
Increasingly, it looks as if we are doomed in that we are seeing greenhouse gas emissions rising very rapidly. We are seeing a collapse in the mechanisms which we have put in place to try and limit greenhouse gas emissions, for example, a collapse in the international carbon market. and a general realization that the move towards biofuels, far from solving the problems of climate change, is actually adding to them. And so I think the outlook is actually very bad. The only positive thing I can say about that is that it's really the first step towards solving the problem is to recognize that what we are doing at the moment is probably making things worse rather than better. And that we need a wholly new system to actually get greenhouse gas emissions under control.
And what would that new system be?
Well, I would argue for Kyoto 2. I wrote a book about this a couple of years ago, and I think the arguments are still slowly permeating through and gaining strength. And one key idea is that you regulate fossil fuels, not where the pollution comes out of the chimney, but upstream, where the fossil fuel comes out of the ground. Now, that could be at the oil refinery, for example, because that's a place where the flow is very concentrated, or at coal washing stations, but places where the flow is concentrated, where you can put up a kind of paper wall and regulate the flow of fossil fuels through that wall. And that is a way of regulating the entire global production of fossil fuels. And instead of having some complex carbon rationing system of the kind that we've got, trying to divide up emission rights among countries, you simply have an auction system. So you auction the rights to produce carbon. These would then have to be bought by the fossil fuel companies. And this would give rise to significant funds of the order of $1 trillion per year, which could then be used to tackle the problems of climate change. Now, fossil fuels are quite easily regulated through an upstream system. You can use that to raise the funds and then spend the funds in other important contributors to climate change, such as deforestation, by rewarding countries using these funds for conserving their forests, by financing technological transition, by accelerating the shift to renewables, by investing on a large scale in research and development in renewable energies. And this is a system which would apply globally. Poor countries would still have to pay the cost of carbon, but they would be receiving the lion's share of the spending on forests and on accelerating the transition towards renewable energy and energy conservation.
And is the reason for the acceleration last year, the record bad year for carbon pumping into the emissions, was that because of the continued economic growth of countries like India and China?
Yes, most of the growth took place in the industrialized developing countries, such as China, India, Brazil, and so on, where in fact the economies are doing well and growing fast, whereas fossil fuel consumption in the developed world remained relatively stagnant.
How long have we got left, Oliver, if this cannot be reversed? What's doomsday?
Well, the truth is that we don't know. The climate system is immensely complex. Climate models are probably quite unreliable, and that may work to our favour or it may work against us. I would say that realistically, the time that we have to reform the climate governance system is probably about 10 years.
And I think 10 years, Oliver says, we've got before it'll be too late. I'm afraid once more, that's all we've got time for. I've been George Galloway. This has been The Real Deal. You've been a wonderful audience.
Baby, you're the real